This is Jeff Whitley, and I'm at the Vietnam Archive. It's Monday, July 11th, 2005. It's about 2:10 in the afternoon, and I'm visiting with Mr. Andy Vart, United States Marine Corps. He was a fellow classmate of Lee Herron, attended language school in 1968, and we're going to share a little bit about his recollections of Lee as a person. And thank you, Mr. Vart, for coming today. We were talking a little bit earlier until we went on tape. What we're going to do is maybe just share a bit some information about you personally. If you'd state your name and your rank and give me some unit information, if you would mind.
At the time in that I met Lee would have been mid-1968 in Monterey. At the time I was a first lieutenant in the Marine Corps. I had come back from a year's tour in Vietnam where I was with the 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines. I was an infantry officer, like Lee, and a platoon commander. And I was assigned to the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, arriving in approximately the beginning of April or the end of March of 1968 to learn Chinese Mandarin. So strictly speaking, I wasn't a classmate of Lee's. Mm-hmm. I attended the school in overlapping periods of time because Lee arrived well into the school period, for me anyway. So,
the events, what got you interested in joining the Marine Corps, and kind of give me some information as far as where you're from, your hometown, where you grew up, and then how you, your education and your background there.
I was born in Europe. I was a refugee with my parents from World War II. I was born in Estonia. Tallinn, Estonia. My mother and I fled that country in about 2 months after I was born, in October 1944, while my father was serving in the German Air Force fighting against the Russians. My mother and I arrived in the United States in 1950, my father the year later, and we settled in New York City where I grew up and went through high school. During my high school period, I became interested in service for a variety of reasons. One, we were in effect at war with a country that had driven my family out of its home and out of its ancestral home. And so I was imbued with a certain patriotic spirit and a certain sense of obligation to join the service. It was I also was blessed to have applied for the Naval Reserve Officer Training Corps scholarship at the University of Rochester in New York, and was accepted, and went through 4 years at the University of Rochester, and was commissioned a second lieutenant on June 5th, 1966. I had taken the Marine Corps option because I admired the Marine officers who were in charge. And I was always infected by the Guadalcanal March of Richard Rogers' Navy, Victory at Sea. Sorry to admit that, but that's music that played a role.
Absolutely.
In any event, from graduating in Rochester, I went to basic school in Quantico, like all other Marines did, and as Lee would have done, as Lee did, and left for Vietnam at the beginning of 1967. Served as platoon commander for about 9 months, as a staff officer for the remainder. And returned to the United States just at about the time of the Tet Offensive. was unmarried at the time, and I only mention it because in the social occasions that I met with Lee, I was dating a girl from Northern California, and the times socially we saw Lee and Annie was when that girl would be with me in Monterey.
Tell me a little bit about your service in the field, and when you landed, what unit were you with, and what were your
Well, when I went over, I initially flew into flew from Camp, well, Southern California to Okinawa, where we had about a week more training, and from there flew in one evening into Da Nang. I guess I was fated to have good luck, because the last thing I did in Okinawa before getting on the plane was to play the slot machine, and I won $50.
That's a good sign.
That was in contrast to this poor officer who made the terrible mistake of putting his cover on, his hat on, in the officer's club when his flight was called, and he had to buy everybody a drink, which was a norm. Now, I don't know if Lee would have known about those things, since Lee didn't drink. But he was unfortunate. I was luckier. I was pretty quickly assigned to the 1st Marine Division and went through meetings traveled through division headquarters, where I had an interview with the commanding officer of the 1st Division. His name was Nickerson, but it's neither here nor there. I just was talking about it earlier with lunch about the entry at that point. It was really kind of bizarre, because I expected some sort of a pep talk from a general officer. But instead, we got a lecture about the accidental discharge of weapons. And we were told in no uncertain terms, the two officers who were there, that we would be in big trouble if we had that happen in our units. Then I went through regimental headquarters, where I spent a couple of days in orientation. Then I was assigned to Lima Company and given the 1st Platoon. 90% of our activity down where we were located, which was south of the city of Da Nang, was in the rice paddy foothill environment that was that part of I Corps. Of that activity, the vast majority was against irregular forces. The biggest concerns were the occasional. Well, not occasional, regular sniper fire, regular booby traps, the things that in today's military they call IEDs. with occasional larger operations into the mountainous regions that were south and west of Da Nang. And we were under fire most days. But I can nothing on the scale that most Marines experienced up in Northern I Corps, and the kind of engagement that Lee fell to. Then we went afloat, and after 9 months, our unit went afloat, supporting other operations ashore. And at that point, I was a staff officer responsible for getting us aboard, getting equipment out to the field, and occasionally going out to the field with material. And we had some more serious engagements up there with main force units. And that's about sort of a summary. My memories of that period are in bits and pieces, and I tend to be, and this is what you'll hear from me later, I tend to put my experiences into summary form, mm-hmm. as opposed to remembering them in fine detail.
Sure.
And so I often feel at a disadvantage, and I'll apologize in advance for not having detailed memories of all the things that one would like to have detailed memories of. Or not. Maybe one wouldn't like, but in any case.
you first met Lieutenant Heron, take me from the time that you were that you left country,
yeah,
and then you went back to the States, and then
right
your career from there until you met Lee Heron.
Okay. Well, I mean, there wasn't much of a career at that point. So if I returned to the United States in what would have been February of 68, I went home to the East Coast. And I guess it was a sort of typical arrival. You know, we flew in from we flew out of Vietnam with a group of others in a C-130 to Okinawa. So the plane had to kickstart, actually. It was kind of funny.
Yeah,
one of the four engines wouldn't start. Mm-hmm. And you know, we were in the plane, and we were told to get out. Mechanics came up, and they opened the cowling. One of the mechanics pulled out this big black object about the size of this recorder, maybe a little bit bigger, and threw it to the ground, buttoned it back up again. Plane went to the end of the runway, went down to the runway with three engines going, and it came back with the fourth on as well, and we all got on board, and off we went. Nobody gave a second thought to doing that.
You know,
with tap breaking out all over, and
sure,
you know, much interested in staying. The right, we were helping it. We were all holding up our seats to lie around. The people were there in all sorts of disarray, not just in seats, but some were sitting on the floor. And from Okinawa, flew into, I guess, Travis Air Force Base on some commercial plane. And we were searched in Travis, make sure we didn't have anything nasty with us. And I raced down to San Francisco International Airport and caught a TWA flight into New York City, barely making it. There I, from New York City, I took a bus to New Jersey where my parents had moved since I graduated from college, and spent 30 days decompressing, basically. And then flew out to California and drove up, actually flew to Long Beach, where I picked up a car which I had ordered before leaving for Vietnam the year before. I guess I had a certain, decided that I was coming back one way or another. But in a way that would need a car. So I had a car drove up to Monterey and began school there. I was studying Chinese. It was a pretty intense course. Any of the courses up there were very intense. The classes, typically, you were engaged in class 6 hours a day. I don't know how the Vietnamese language instruction was run. I can only imagine that it was fairly similar to the Chinese language instruction, which really focused heavily on the memorization of vocabulary and sentence structure. And the device they used would probably be unacceptable in most learning institutions today. And that was that we were obliged each and every night to memorize long passages, mostly conversational. And then the following morning and the following classroom sessions, we were to recite portions of those passages. So if a passage involved a conversation, say, between two or three people, two or three of the students in a relatively small class, I think if we had a dozen people in that room, it would be a lot. I'm more inclined to think we were about eight or so. I don't know the size of the Vietnamese classes, but if the formula was the same, then that was what they would have done. We basically got up and played a role. And without any reference materials, person A would recite the first passage in the text. Person B would pick it up and see and go on and simulate these conversations using the actual language and what we had memorized. And we might, you know, switch through and have different people do it. And with the instructors critiquing our work. In the case of the Chinese classes, and I imagine it would have been the same with the Vietnamese classes, we had a different instructor for every hour. So we weren't stuck with the same person. We had a very fixed syllabus, extensive notebooks with vocabulary, and for Chinese, the Chinese characters that we eventually were introduced to. We didn't get those until later, but and we had to memorize those, and we would be grilled on those. After the planned conversations, we would have conversations that the instructors would generate.
So you would pick up the syntax.
You'd pick up syntax, you'd pick up tone, you'd pick up mood, all that stuff, because the instructors were really, really good. If there's one critique we might have of it, some were better than others. It was a little bit inconsistent, because there were some instructors who wanted to engage in sort of extemporaneous conversations that traveled away from the text, either because they were too energetic to stick to the routine, or they had gotten bored with the routine, or were easily distracted.
Were these Anglo instructors?
No, they were all Chinese.
Okay, gotcha.
And again, I'd be surprised if it was any different in the Vietnamese course. I know the Russian course were all native Russian speakers, and that was Monterey's really claim to a reputation. You know, in later years, when I finished the Marine Corps in 1970, I left the Marine Corps because there was really nothing for a Chinese speaker to do, and I was close to as fluent as you can get without living in country. I went to the University of Michigan where they tested me in my language, and it tested out at better than third year university level. So in 1 year's time in this intensive class, I'd gotten 3 years worth at least of that. And the only thing that held me back was my vocabulary, because the vocabulary instruction, the character recognition part of the vocabulary instruction was fairly limited.
Did you take an aptitude test to get into?
We all took aptitude tests before we left basic school. At some point in there, maybe even earlier, but I thought it was during basic school that we took your basic language aptitude test, and I think I had a fairly high score at that point.
Your memory, is it close to photographic, or is it...
My memory? Oh, no.
People said that, or actually, it was Lee's sister said that she felt like that he had a photographic memory, that he'd just see something or hear something, and he would just recall.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's possible. Can I go to the bathroom?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, me too. I'll have to kind of feel around for it, I think. I'm
not sure where it is.
This one's 121 on Calvert.
Oh, the play again, maybe again? Let's try that.
About this one here.
Yeah, we're running now.
Okay. Anyway, I mean, in terms of what it would take to learn a language in that kind of a setting, I really can't, in retrospect, think of a more effective way than the mechanisms they used there. Mm-hmm. And if they used it in the Vietnamese language course, I would think that you'd come out with a pretty strong foundation. 6 months, which was Lee's program, you know, isn't a lot. I don't know what level they expect them to come out at, but you're certainly going to come out well ahead of rudimentary, and given the focus on the military vocabulary, I think you'd come out with a reasonably solid foundation. Mm-hmm. I don't think you're going to engage in super intense political conversations or highly technical conversations on other subjects, but that's just speculation on my part. Ours was a very heavily military focused conversation that we tended to get into once we got past the social kinds of conversations that we learned.
Right.
We could engage up to some degree in political stuff, but you know, not that well, or certainly not in economic stuff.
Sure.
So given the needs of the time, that's what I'd expect. I'd be willing to bet you could get a feel for it if you could find the books. I even still have some of mine from Monterey. They were, bunch of volumes.
How much of that stuff sticks?
How much that's, a lot of it stuck. It doesn't. What sticks today is not that. What sticks is the construction, some of the social banter. I can get along pretty well up to a point. But when conversations begin to get focused on specific things, then I really have trouble dredging up my vocabulary. And in the case of the Chinese, what you really lose is are the characters. And you don't have that with the Vietnamese. It's all written, so mostly written.
Not all officers went into language school.
Very few did.
Very few.
Yeah. And I don't know what the numbers are and why.
Weren't you part of an elite group then, really?
You know, I don't know. I guess I didn't really think of it in those terms. If I had to speculate, I'd say I wouldn't think of it that way. I can't remember what Lee's attitude was about being there in the first place. In a way, it put him at a disadvantage. And I get the impression from conversations, or at least a conversation with, I think it was Jim Davis, that Lee really did feel disadvantaged by language school. Not that he was put into a special place.
Pigeonholed, maybe?
No, because it kept him out of place.
Yeah.
It kept him out of, the routine for officers like me was pretty straightforward and hard to snap. You land in Vietnam, you're a second lieutenant, you've got 6 months in grade up to that point, having been to basic school, maybe seven at most, and you take a platoon for a year. By then, or you have a platoon for less, and by then you're on the edge of first lieutenant, and you're no longer platoon commander. And so by going to language school for 6 months, in effect, Lee was shut out of being a platoon commander. And, that's sort of the foundation level of command. And without it, it's different, seriously different. And I would commend this to you as an avenue of inquiry with Jim Davis. If you need to connect with him, I can try to help you with that or have him connect with you, because I know where he is and I see him periodically. Because he knows, he talked with Lee in Vietnam, and he knows Lee's thinking about such things at the time. I can't remember what he said, if anything, on this subject. The only thing I could offer is that what was really interesting to Lee wasn't... Let me put that back up. That's not the way I want to put it. What I remember talking to Lee with Lee about the Vietnam experience that I'd had was not about the Vietnamese people necessarily, but about combat, about the things that I learned, things that he presumed he would benefit from knowing, having talked to somebody who'd been on the ground. So that he used his time in Monterey not only to learn his language but to try to build up his knowledge about fighting the war.
You mentioned in your talk at the memorial ceremony about that you talked often about military science.
Yeah.
Strategy or whatnot.
Right. To the degree, I don't remember many of those conversations today. I know we had them, and I know that he was intensely interested in my experiences. And my experiences, as I described to you earlier, and I would have told him the same thing at the time, were of a particular kind. And any student of the war will tell you there were bunches of different kinds of wars going on. Mm-hmm. And we might have been engaged in a couple of the different kinds and not in others. The sort of engagement in which Lee was killed was something I'd never experienced.
Did they tell you about what you specifically were going to be using your language skills and Mandarin for?
Oh, in my case, I'm quite confident that since nobody explained anything to me, that it was a matter of a quota having to be filled, and they found somebody who had a good language aptitude and was coming out of Vietnam at about the right time to land in the class, and they could fill their quota. Plus, there was always that sort of perspective of the Chinese threat looming over North Vietnam, and that we might, in the end, end up in a war with them. So that was really the only reason. I had no idea why I was going. I didn't apply for it. When I got my orders, I didn't even understand what they were, because they said it was just code. It was CM-47 something yada yada, Monterey, DLIWC Monterey. I took it to the company first sergeant and said, "Top, what is this? What does this mean?" He said, "Oh, sir, that's a language school in Monterey, California." And I said, "Do I want to go there?" And he said, "Oh, yes, sir, it's a nice place." I said, "Okay." That was my career management. And as a student, you know, I thought I was an okay student, and I knew that in my class I was probably the best. But I wasn't really an exemplary student. And, you know, in that regard, you know, I think that Lee was a very different personality than I was, yet, you know, I could relate to him very easily, and I think because he related very easily to many others. You know, I knew then that he was a very fundamental Christian, mm-hmm. and Foursquare Baptist, as I understood it. And, you know, I understood that. I was not a particularly religious person, but I had spent many summers on a farm in upstate New York, and the farmer and his family were Southern Baptists. And we went to church 3 times a week. And in my cynical self, I would say probably that's covered me for my life. But and I drank a lot. But Lee was forgiving. When we were together, we didn't drink. And you know, that was probably a good relief for me, because I drank a lot.
Did you know that Lee wasn't really a professing Christian back in high school?
Mm-hmm.
And one of the questions that I wanted to try to answer is, when did he make that commitment? And how influential was Danielle, his wife, in that process? And is this something that he
can... Yeah, I can't help you on either count. Yeah. Because as far as, you know, my memory tells me, I thought they were both there. Mm-hmm. And I will say, I can't say that he was evangelical.
Right.
Neither pressed their faith, but it was quite evident that it was there. And, you know, when we had dinner, you know, there would be grace. Mm-hmm. And I'd recognize from his prayers where he stood, but it was never a subject of other kinds of conversations.
Do you remember the first time you saw him?
Honestly, I don't. I could not put my finger on
sure.
it. I mean, I can only tell you that that I could see he was a strong young man, and
physically about being around him. Was he intimidating, or was he intense?
I couldn't say that I couldn't say that the word intense comes, and I wouldn't say that the word intimidating comes to mind. But I mean, I was another Marine, so you know, maybe some civilian might have seen both of those things there, and maybe by that point in time, in my own experience, I didn't identify people that way.
Right.
He was serious. He was serious about the uniform he wore. He wore it with meticulous attention to detail. His grooming was meticulous, and I have no doubt in an inspection that he would have stood out vastly superior to me. But you know, it wasn't. You know, it never occurred to me to think in any way that he was showing off or being unreal. He was being a good, solid, top-notch Marine that he proved to be.
You said that you had a chance to have conversations with him, private conversations. I mean, you probably have bits and pieces of recollections of the conversations you
You know, it's... I don't know if their memories are just creations. And mostly, you know, what I would have talked about was our various kinds of operational experiences. Mm-hmm. And I remember a few. And, you know, whether they be, you know, just working the rice paddies, working sniper engagements, working off the aircraft carrier, the landing platform helicopter, the LPH, kinds of situations our units were in at those times. That's really the best I can recollect. I'm sorry.
In letters that Lee wrote home and to his friends and family, he talked a little bit about the student protest and the things that were going on in Southern California when he was out there. Did you guys have a chance to visit about the political atmosphere and about any of that? What his thoughts were on?
That rings no bells. In terms of the, you know, the political environment of things, as much as I hate to say it, most of the political conversations that I engaged in was in a little bar in Monterey, mm-hmm. with a couple of other Marines and, you know, roommates in particular. And so Lee wouldn't have been part of those. Mm-hmm. And you know, I don't know how intensely I felt it up there at the time. Where I really, and this, we're talking late 1968, mid 1968. You know, Johnson's resignation or decision not to run for office again. I guess Chicago would have been taking place that year. Vaguely remember watching the stuff on TV. I can't say that I remember having strong feelings at the time of dismay. Yeah, you know, I think, you know, I start getting some of the bits and bytes in my brain moving around. I remember a few things, not Monterey connected particularly, and I remember estrangement from people I'd known before, and, you know, including a young lady I was pretty much in love with when I went to Vietnam, and, or even before, actually, it started to come apart. And some correspondence of my own with, I have to admit this, is another girl from the University of Texas. And she sent me a very unkind letter at some point while I was in Vietnam. So, you know, it happened here too, in this state. I don't remember talking very much. I don't remember a conversation with Lee about it at all, to be honest. I don't doubt that we would have talked about it.
He didn't drink, but did he go to the bar with you?
No.
Just socialize?
No.
Did you guys ever grab a weekend, go to the beach, or hang out or whatever?
One never had to go away for a weekend to go to the beach there.
Right,
you're
there.
Yeah, the beach of Carmel was very, very short drive, and Buttered Beach, a place to hang out. I don't remember if he and Danielle went there or not. They must have. I'm sure they did.
Tell me what you remember about Danielle.
Gosh. I'm a lousy subject for an interview. I remember them both as being very pleasant and attractive people. I remember Danielle as being that. It seemed to me that she was inquisitive and devoted. But beyond that, I can't remember. And I remember as being very brave here when I brought Lee home. And I remember her being very insistent on having an opportunity to see him. Because my instructions were that I wasn't to be an open casket. And, you know, I was intent, I had actually seen him when he first, when I first went to pick him up in Travis. And, no, it wasn't there. It had to have been, where it was. It was here in Lubbock. Lee was pressing to see him.
I'm sorry, but since we're on that subject, can you back up a little bit and tell me about those events?
Get chronological.
I'm sorry. No, okay. Well, yeah. I think it's just, you said, it's a very important role you play.
I mean, yes. And it's one that you're not prepared for. The story as I related it was really surreal. And essentially, as I said, I was near the end of my course, and at that point I was sharing an apartment with three other officers in language school. I guess maybe two other officers in language school, and I was sitting by myself late one afternoon reading the Navy Times and leafing through it. That's when I saw the picture. And I said, that's cool, that's just like Lee.
Describe what you saw.
Well, I saw the image. I saw the image in the Navy Times of this church service taking place in the field, with a hovering helicopter in the background, with cut down shrubs and trees on the treetop on the hilltop, and sitting in the front row nearest the camera was Lee. And then standing behind the pulpit was a minister, and I, as I said, I thought that was just like him, and I actually intent on cutting the image out at that point, and it was as I was gazing at it, the telephone rang, and I went to it and picked it up and identified myself, and on the other end, I can't remember his name, was a Marine captain. He said he was the INI officer, and that is the officer who is responsible for reserve training and other administrative things within a given region. And his was that part of Texas, which included Lubbock. I don't know whether they had one assigned here or not. I don't know. And he said that Lee had been killed, and that Danielle had asked me to escort him home. Because they were always given the option of having someone come with him.
And what was your gut response to that?
My immediate reaction, the whole event just took my breath away, having just seen the image. I felt like I'm punched in the stomach. And I said, of course, and that was the only answer. And then I told him about the image, and he said that he would strive to get the original, or an original of it, or a print of it, which he did. I knew at the time that would be an important one for them.
Do you have that print?
I have one, I think, yes. I don't have the newspaper clipping. I don't think I have the print. And so he gave me instructions on what I was to do.
What were you to do?
I was to, including what uniform I needed to wear and so on, and I was to get myself up to Travis Air Force Base, where his body would be brought in, and then accompany it on several stages that it would take to fly him back to Lubbock. I can't remember all the steps now, but from Travis, it had to have been a vehicle of some sort down to San Francisco. Or maybe I just met him in San Francisco. That's what happened. And I was supposed to be with the casket at every stage of the way, and I could never leave the airplane or leave the side of the casket when it was taken out of the airplane. And so from there, I think we flew to Los Angeles, where we had a connecting, an new flight to Lubbock with at least one stop in between.
So in San Francisco, you're cleared for security, and you go in and you see...
There wasn't any security, really.
Did you see that?
Yeah, I went to a baggage, or not baggage, but cargo area, and he was there. And
were there others?
I don't think so. At least I didn't see any others, or wasn't looking. I might have been given a flag to bring with me. It wasn't draped in the flag at the time. And so we flew from there to L.A., where it was unloaded again, and then it was placed in an aircraft to come here. And it wasn't easy to do. I think we flew, what was the original DC-9?
Just logistically, it wasn't easy.
To maneuver it into the cargo hold. Because remember, it was a good-sized casket. Mm-hmm. And then we were met by the hearse at the airport.
In Lubbock. And that's when you first saw his body?
At the funeral home. I don't remember the funeral home. What I'm trying to remember is if Lee's family was there at the airport. I'm inclined to say they were. I can't remember for sure. They probably would remember. But it makes sense for them to have been there.
Sounds like his hearing, she would be there.
Yeah, and Danielle, I think, would have been there too. I'm not sure.
Daniel.
Yeah. Then my first assignment was to be stand by his body during what would be called the viewing, but was the gathering before the memorial service, and then to be present at the memorial service. It was between those events, I think, that it was certainly between those events that Daniel wanted to see Leroy's body. Sorry for my coughing. The reason I'm doing it is because I've had radiation treatment, and so I have a little. That's okay. So it was at that point, I think, at the funeral home that I asked them to open the casket to reassure myself, you know, what she would see. And the truth was that I didn't quite understand why it was considered a closed casket affair. But she was there. What did she do? Her ring. This would be a. Did she? She wanted to be sure that she had his ring, or that he had it on, and did she take it? She may have taken it. And do you know? Was that discussed anywhere? Do you know?
This hearing several years ago, they mentioned that, mm-hmm. that personal belongings that she had given mm-hmm. Back to this hearing. Mm-hmm. I don't recall the ring.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah. And.
But she basically insisted, did you have to tell her that it was supposed to be a closed casket, and did that matter?
I did tell her, and it didn't matter. She wanted to see him one last time. I left her alone with him. I imagined some disfigurement. It wasn't there. The issue would have been just the quality of the...
Right.
So, and he was probably decked out in his uniform and so on.
Yeah.
And then I think the memory that comes back, and maybe I related to the conversation, was that I came back probably more comforted than I offered comfort of my own.
Because the family was very gracious.
Right, it was very gracious.
Do you remember Mr. Heron?
Honestly, I know he was there, but I don't.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that was, like you said, surreal.
Yeah.
Like a flash.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was strange. No, it wasn't. Yeah, it wasn't strange. I mean, it was very comforting to see the feeling around. And maybe in the... And you know, when you put it in the context of the rest of the time, you know, this is sort of projection too. Mm-hmm. This was a family of devotion, and this was a community of devotion, and this was a community of love. And it wasn't a community of bitterness or anger.
Right.
And if it had been those things, the experience would have been very different. It wasn't a community in which people were asking why Lee.
Right.
And you know, I don't even know how well they knew how he died. I don't think I remember knowing how heroically he died. Because the Navy Cross came much later, would have come much later. Maybe I was told he was put up for it, I don't know. I knew he had been shot in the assault. But that's...
Ms. Heron said there was a couple of little places she noticed on his head or something, but yeah. She said he looked good, she said.
Yeah, he did.
I want to try to get anything, kind of go back to the lead in your conversations with him. Anything you can give me at all about his conversations you had, anything that you remember, stories that you might remember since we've had a few minutes to talk. We'll move on.
Yeah.
You said you had social opportunities and you had a few meals with
right.
with the Herons. And,
right.
And
you know, you want to ask why did Danielle pick me?
Right.
You know, I don't know if her feelings were that strong about us and our relationship, or whether she knew. I don't know how many Marines she knew.
Right.
I don't know how big the Marine Corps family of hers that she would have known, and how many she would have imagined would have been available to help. And you know, it may have come down to that she knew me better than anybody that was available, or anybody at all mm-hmm. who was a Marine. So. And because all the classmates, who conceivably they associated with more, and I don't know, because I don't remember any occasion that there were more than just Lee and Danielle and Jean and I.
Right.
So I don't know how much they socialized with the others of their particular peer group. And as the language training was not service specific, you know, there may not have been another Marine in his class. I don't know. So it's entirely possible that of all the Marines who were there, I may have been the only one they met or really socialized with. I have no idea. No idea. It seems like a stretch. Because I think they were both very sociable people. But also, there's a lot of work that had to be done. I mean, it was hard work. So you couldn't socialize that much.
Right.
I mean, if you were a good student, you weren't going to. If you were a bad student, then you did.
Well, just your account of when you were looking at the Navy Times and you see this photograph and reflecting on it mm-hmm. and discovering this image in your head.
Yeah.
And then suddenly you get the call, that's just...
Yeah.
Far-fetched. I mean, it's just amazing.
I you could say it was, in a sense, sort of miraculous in its own way.
Sure.
Depending on your vocabulary.
Did you think the fact that you might be divinely chosen for that office?
I think there's whether you call it fate, the imposition of some divine effect, to get me ready for that moment, or am I the device to discover that photo? Now, who knows? Who would have seen it?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know whether David followed the Navy Times at the time or not. A photo like that could just disappear, and in that context would.
That's right. That's right. So. This whole story is framed by that photograph, as you know. Mm. We talked about interesting stories that you may or may not could tell about your
relationship with Lee. We talked about language school. And you touched on that he was a Christian man. And, you know, that was a very personal thing to him. He didn't necessarily, he wasn't evangelical. He didn't hit anybody over the head with it, but just about the way he lived.
Yeah. Well, and you know it from the one letter of his that I've ever seen. And he believed in clearly he believed in his mission, believed in what he was supposed to do, and he believed in God's hand to do what was the right thing to do, that no matter what the outcome. He was ordained to be that way. Like you, I don't know if you'll ever know what's transpired in the wake of Lee's death and how Danielle has led her life since then or what. And I sometimes have wondered whether there was any resentment from Lee's parents about her going into another life. I don't even know what kind of a life she's really led since then. But there's no doubt that he had instructed her to go on with her life. And so I hope there hasn't been anything like that. It'd be hard for me to imagine that there is, but so to me an interesting element to this is, and perhaps an important one, is the question of how do widows cope, deal, and move on in that kind of a circumstance. And the story, and there must be thousands of that story, with 53,000 dead, and how many of us were moved into marriage, at that point in time. It was sort of one of the things quite a few officers did.
Right.
Marriage their college sweethearts right after they graduate, go to basic school, and off they go, and some never returned. So there's a whole story there, and how they coped, and or didn't. I guess some didn't. And how the husbands communicated their sense of their missions. There was nothing that I ever saw that would have conveyed any message to Danielle or the family that his life would be wasted in an effort like this. I was a bit superstitious, as I would never write a letter like that.
Right.
And you had the perception of people who did have them read.
Right.
And I was disinclined to seal my fate, as it were. So I bought a car instead.
Tell me about when you first got in contact with David Nelson.
Yeah, how did that work out? I guess an email.
Yeah, an email.
Yeah, the modern day email business, right?
But we discovered.
Are you the guy?
Yeah. We discovered the photograph. Jane Graham had brought the picture in. We talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, David discovers you.
Yeah.
And
sought me out. Right.
Right. And so. And your response to the invitation to come for the memorial ceremony, mm-hmm. and to be involved with the scholarship program and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And your presentation was very, very nice, very, very fitting. And you had some of the comments you made, laughter broke out, and it was just the perfect strand, I think, in that memorial ceremony. You want to share anything about that day? Kind of how you felt about the approach and all?
Well, I was pretty nervous. I don't consider myself an accomplished public speaker. I thought I thought a long time about what I would say, but it wasn't really until the flight over that I composed what I would say. I've decided I come from the Abraham Lincoln School of Speech Writing. Do it on the trip.
That's right.
Because otherwise you think it to death.
Had you been to Lubbock since the funeral?
No. Okay. That was first. As I said, I think the conversation had to be the picture and had to be faith. And the power that moves you to do things you might not otherwise do. I understood and I understand the Christian setting in which Lee led his life, in which he left his life here, and I imagine the way he's being remembered. And my message was understanding that, but also understanding the sort of secular context of faith, this implicit message that we are carried through our challenges, our difficult times, by some faith. I always called him Leroy. It seemed to me we always knew him as Leroy. I always knew him as Leroy. I understood that his was the Christian faith, and that carried him through, and that carried others through. And so I simply wanted to highlight that as the photograph demonstrated it, being lived at that moment, that even in those conditions, those were horrendous conditions for a church service. You probably could hardly hear anybody talk with blades going right there in the background. They weren't far away. And the ever-present potential of incoming fire from some quarter. I mean, helicopters were nice targets. They're proceeding to practice their faith. I imagine that all of those men in that little gathering were of different faiths.
Right.
And that they were sitting there together under horrendous conditions praying as they felt was apt at that time. And I think that the other thought was in conveying Jim Davis's message. I knew Jim because he worked at CIA also. I met him only because my wife worked for him in a component. And my wife is ever watchful for other Marines and possible relationships. And I knew Jim Davis. Before coming to this, to the memorial service, I was doing some reading in some material, and I don't know where I got this now, but there was one book about the battle. I don't think it's a published book, but it was circulating somehow, describing the battle and some of the people in it, including the Lieutenant James Davis, who was the platoon commander of the platoon that Lee led in that charge.
Was it Don't Tell America, was it?
That might have been, yeah.
The March
it was,
test.
Yeah, it was. Who wrote that? I don't remember what the. I mean, what? Anyway.
You're the second person to ask that on tape here, and I'm trying to remember the man's name.
The record will show that your ignorance is abysmal. You better fix it the next interview.
That's right.
In any case.
It's out of print. It's
Davis's name was there, and surely they have it here.
I have it. I have a copy.
Oh, you've got a copy, okay. And it just occurred to me, it's James H. Davis. Could it be? And I popped an email, an inner office email, to him, and he said yes. And I said, did you know? And he didn't.
Wow.
Well, he knew, of course. I mean, he didn't know about the memorial service.
Right.
And that's, I don't understand that. To this day, I don't know how Dave Nelson arranged things, and it didn't occur to me. And I think I did mention him to him beforehand. I'm pretty sure I did. But by that point, Jim didn't feel that he could come, circumstances at work, or whether there was a certain tension. And I only say that much because it's not for me to talk about it, but
sure.
I think there is tension between at least a couple of the officers of the unit and Fox, mm-hmm. Wesley Fox. And since I wasn't there and I don't know the circumstances, I don't know how decisions were made. I think there's some controversy about whether the best decisions were made.
Right.
Maybe you already heard that. But in any case, I mean, there's somebody you really need to talk to. Because I think my hunch is, my feeling is that Jim and Lee had the word in daily conversation.
Do you think it'd be possible for you to get Jim here?
I don't know if he'd come out this way or not. Might be easier for you to go there. But I'll talk to him.
Just talk to him on the phone.
You couldn't have this conversation on the phone.
Gotcha.
It would take a long time. Jim talks, and he talks with feeling. And he has great passion about the time and about his role,
absolutely,
about those particular events. He would later go on to be the commander of the Marines in that operation to free those who were the Mayaguez. I don't know if you know that story.
No, not entirely.
Well, he was in charge of the Marines who landed on that island to attempt to free what they thought were the hostages from the Mayaguez. Turned out they weren't there. And it turned out they got into an awful fight. Mm-hmm. And it also turned out that three Marines were left behind. And they didn't know it initially because two companies were combined. And when he took his off, they thought they had everybody, but they didn't. And so, you know, he's a man who lives his life with these sorts of ghosts. And I'm sure that in that operation, he probably feels the same sort of ghost about Lee leading his platoon in that fateful moment, a job that he should have been, in his mind, doing.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So, and so in terms of what Lee was thinking about Lee's faith, because Jim was, I don't know if he is anymore, a man of great faith.
Okay.
You would probably get a lot more than you could, than you can get from me.
Do you want to talk at all, as a wrap up here, about Leroy's? I mean, through the years, I'm sure you thought of Lee many times, and mm-hmm. do you think of him often? And how did he leave an imprint on your life? What do you think that we learn from a life like Lee's? Because there are many, many, many thousands of men like Lee who died like him.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lee was always provided let's put it this way, I can't say that I lived up to his ideals. And so he always usually provided a measure of how badly I was leading my life. Get that off the table. At the same time, and I think this is basically encompassed in my message, that you know, the message of Lee's life is that you make many of your life's choices on faith and belief and devotion to a few major principles, and then you carry it out to the extent, I if you're, you can, whatever the consequences are. You don't back away from duty. You carry it out no matter how controversial the time may be, you know, provided that duty brings you to advance the lawful causes of the country, in this case, is military service. Sometimes that, the full implications or the full consequences or the full context, and so the political, diplomatic context, isn't apparent in that to those of us ordinary mortals who carry the rifles or give the commands. And it's, yet it's, you know, we understand what our duty is and then we perform it. Some of us more heroically than others, but we perform it. And that's what Lee exemplifies. He paid the price, the ultimate price that we pay for those kinds of decisions made way above us, but he had faith that he was doing the right thing. And he had faith that he was in safe hands ultimately. So he had no fear for himself, I'm sure. And so that picture's always there, and this picture's there in the context of today's times. I know we have controversy about the war in Iraq, yet there are men and women now who carry, have to carry that sort of same sort of faith into combat. Regardless of a very complex political climate. So I guess that's kind of where I am.
I appreciate your time today, Andy.
My pleasure. I wish I could be more helpful.
You've been very helpful. And it's 20 minutes after 3 o'clock, and that concludes my interview with Andy Barr. And thank you again, sir.
Thank you.